All right. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're getting a little bit of a late start because Mr. Is it Kala or Kala?
Kala, Your Honor. Thank you.
Kala apparently was stuck in traffic, although I will note that being stuck in traffic for a remote oral argument maybe is not quite as good of an excuse for being late as it might be for in-person oral arguments, but we will set that aside. And thanks to everyone for being patient for our calendar to start. Marshall, because this is being recorded, please state your name when you start your argument. As you well know, no doubt, the appellant is 15 minutes with 5 minutes for rebuttal, and the respondent has 15 minutes in between. So with that, Marshall, do you want to call our first case?
Yes, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Riley, and Judge Smith, the Honorable Susan L. Siegel presiding. Calling case A21-1062, Kara Quinn, respondent, versus LMCNE, Minneapolis Holdings, LLC, et al. Appellants.
All right. With that, Mr. Kala, you can proceed. And as everybody well knows by now, if there are any technical difficulties, anybody can't hear each other, just let us know and we'll get things hopefully fixed as quickly as possible. So, Mr. Kala, with that, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Your Honor, Ms. Kaczorek. I apologize for the delay. I gave myself 45 minutes for a 15-minute commute and it turned into an hour. I apologize. I appreciate the court's indulgence in this matter. I represent LMCNE Minneapolis Holdings, LLC, LMC Living, LLC, the Nordhaus Apartments in Minneapolis. This is an appeal from a lockout petition. The occupant petitioner, Kara Quinn, was an occupant at a property owned and managed by my client, multi-unit property, 280-unit building. The lockout petition was commenced. There were two hearings on April 27th and a trial on May 5th. After that May 5th trial, the referee and housing court issued a decision in favor of the petitioner, Ms. Quinn, granting her the possessory rights in the property. There was a judge review under Rule 611 with Judge Christian Sandy. He affirmed much of what Referee Hotelling decided with regards to the substantive issues as to Ms. Quinn's status as a tenant. The other issues regarding attorney's fees and a $500 fine were reversed by Judge Sandy, and those were not cross-appealed. The sole legal issue, Your Honors, today is whether or not an occupant in a property qualifies as a residential tenant for the purposes of the Minnesota lockout statute, where the facts are undisputed such that that occupant was not on the written lease, that occupant was aware of the lease, that occupant was violating the lease, that occupant had never submitted an application to them at the property.
Wait, Mr. Kulik, if you said she was aware, was she aware of the terms of the lease? I mean, that doesn't seem to be in the record, correct? You just mean that she knows there was a lease. Is that correct?
She knows there was a lease, and I tried to get into it, Your Honor, with Ms. Quinn, what she understood about written leases, and my questions were objected and overruled and sustained as being irrelevant. So the extent of her knowledge of the specific terms of the lease is not in the record, but also there was nothing in the record undermining what we should expect an occupant in a 280-unit building where Minnesota Statute 504B111 requires written leases. There was nothing in the record undermining the legitimacy or the contents of that lease or Ms. Quinn's knowledge about those parts of the lease. And the last undisputed fact is Ms. Quinn never paid any rent to the landlord.
So, counsel, the issue here is whether is regular occupant, right?
I mean, yes.
So whether there was a lease or not, or the tenant Ms. Quinn thought that there were leases for someone else, the question is whether one is a regular occupant of a tenant who has a lease, right?
Yeah, if we boil this entire issue down, it comes down to the word regular.
Okay, so what do you think the word regular means? And are you suggesting it's as defined by each particular, that the statutory definition depends on the particular lease and by a particular landlord?
So Ms. Quinn's position is that regular has a temporal meaning only. And I don't think that's a fair limitation on what that word means.
In your definition, temporal only, I guess the lease and the terms of the lease, whether it was breached or not, is not relevant. It's just a temporal question. So I'm trying to figure out, what all goes into this? The landlord, let's imagine someone, a tenant who has a lease, just exactly this lease, they have their mother come live with them. The landlord knows the mother's living with them. They don't proceed according to there's never the requirements that of the lease that there be a background check, et cetera. But the landlord fully knows that mother's living there. Is that for years? Is that a not consistent with the lease? Is that mom a regular tenant? I mean, occupant?
I think it goes to a level of intent and knowledge by the landlord. In your situation, could the court conclude that the landlord intended to allow the mother to live at the apartment? If the court makes that finding, perhaps she's a regular occupant. We don't have those findings here. We have an inquiry around December of 2020 about some activity of the property. Landlord makes an inquiry to Ms. Smith, the tenant who actually is on the lease, to try to figure out what's going on. And I don't think this appears in the record, but there's some indications that the landlord is aware. There's elevator use. It looks like somebody's moving out. And they make an inquiry, and I think they understand that Ms. Quinn might be at the property. They send an application to the property, to the apartment. They get no response. And there's nothing in the record.
What would be enough then? So the obligation is then on the whoever's within the unit to let make sure the landlord knows who's there. I mean, this seems like it was pretty open and long-term and that there actually was notice. I mean, that is in the record. I mean, there was enough so that the I don't know if it's the manager, but whoever sent an application to Ms. Smith, correct? I mean, so there was at least notice and evidence of that. And it wasn't occasional. I mean, she was there for at least 2 years, and that is in the record. So what would be enough? What are you saying? And where do you get that in the statutory definition?
So that's the testimony of Ms. Quinn and her, I think Ms. Corey, I forget the name of the other witness that she had.
But we can't, part of this is based on credibility findings. And as an appellate court, we can't say, we believe the landlord's testimony, not Ms. Quinn's testimony, when the court has made a credibility finding, correct?
Well, the credibility finding by Referee Hotelling, I think, is entirely suspect. I mean, I don't believe she's actually saying that Elena Cassidy is lying, okay? I mean, there's no testimony about the interaction that Ms. Quinn had with anybody at the property who had the authority to approve her as an applicant or a tenant in the property. I mean, Referee Hotelling has some findings, I think paragraph 28 or so, about how the landlord is sorting out mail in the mailroom. There's no testimony about that at all. There's no testimony. I mean,
we get that. I get that. That I agree with you that I don't think landlords are supposed to sort through. Now, packages might be something else, but if there's a general package room. But what is it in the statutory language? I mean, what would be required to put the landlord on notice such that Ms. Quinn would have the status of being a regular occupant? And what do you base that on in the statutory language?
I think
I get that you've got, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but But I get that, that you've got a claim that, well, the lease says that she needs approval before anybody else can live in the unit. But that's a claim against Ms. Smith. You could have claimed she was in breach of her lease and maybe even terminated and evicted her based on that breach, but not as to Ms. Quinn. I'll go back to my question now. What is it in the statutory language and what would be enough?
So we would not have been able to evict Ms. Smith for this because during the pandemic, that would not have risen to the level of serious endangerment or significant damage to the property. So during the pandemic, we would not have been able to evict Ms. Smith.
Would in normal times. I mean, we've been through weird times.
Yes.
But under normal times, it would be a claim against Ms. Smith. So anyway, finish the answer.
Well, I think it's also a claim against Ms. Quinn, because here's the question. If she is a tenant, who is her landlord? And if the landlord is my client, LMC Nordhaus, what is the relationship between those two people, LMC and Ms. Quinn? Is there a lease? The only lease that could be is the written lease. And that lease has all types of requirements regarding application, notice, who's on the lease, who's living in the property. Ms. Quinn is in violation of that lease just as much as Ms. Smith is.
So Mr. Hey, no, Kala, Mike, excuse me. Is it okay?
Yeah.
So residential tenant includes a regular occupant. So my question to both of you is that I don't think there's a whole lot of case law out there that interprets this particular statute. And so perhaps we should make it precedential. I'll let both of you weigh in on that. And if we were to do that, what would the syllabus point be? How do you think this court should define regular occupant as used in this particular statute?
I think the court can use Brosco as a starting point and emphasize the word that Brosco touches at head note 4 at page 659. At head note 4, they reference the word and, saying and, the word and makes clear that someone in the group have an agreement with the owner before the law views the other regular occupants as tenants, semicolon, the word, quote, that before, quote, dwelling unit in the last phrase is a reference to the prior language describing the kind of binding promise necessary to create a tenancy. So I think what we have here is using the Brosco, that head note 4 paragraph. Okay, I mean, Brosco has already reported decision. If this court simply takes the Brosco head note 4 and clarifies that to be a regular occupant, there has to be an underlying triggering binding agreement to the first occupant, to the first regular tenant, and that would be Ms. Smith.
So can I ask you another question, though? So this, we're dealing with a statutory right. And so are you claiming that this is a waivable right by the terms of a lease? Because it seems to me that's sort of what you're arguing, is that the terms of the lease, like, let's just assume as a hypothetical that Ms. Quinn is a regular occupant. Then is that a statutory right that's waivable by a lease?
Well, even if it is, it's not waived in this instance because the regular occupancy that Ms. Quinn is claiming to is based off of a written lease that has requirements in it. And the problem
that's what I'm asking. You're saying the lease can trump that section of the landlord-tenant statute.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is are not a regular occupant if ab initio you are violating the lease. And that's the problem we have here. Is Ms. Quinn
But maybe we're quibbling over words. So you're saying that if a provision in a lease says you can't live here, nobody can live here unless you're signatory to this lease, but we conclude that Ms. Quinn is in fact a regular occupant within the meaning of the statute. So are you arguing that that lease provision then trumps that you can, through your lease, get a tenant to agree to waive that provision of the statute?
Well, I think the premise of your argument, Judge Siegel, is that a regular occupant is somebody who is simply there all the time, notwithstanding what the written terms of the lease say. And that's where I have the objection, is that my client is getting foisted upon them an occupant who hasn't abided by the lease, and neither has Ms. Smith for that matter. But yet now she's an occupant. She wants to be a tenant, but she doesn't want to abide the lease. She's never abided by the lease. And that's where I have a real problem with this court recognizing the status of Ms. Quinn as a regular occupant.
So, counsel, this sort of gets back to my question, I guess, at the start. And that's why, and I appreciate the struggle of this. We're trying to figure out what regular means in here when you're someone other than the tenant. And I get, you know, things that we talked about was temporal, but I think temporal, obviously, you would argue is not enough if the landlord doesn't know, you know, if someone's secretly living there. Clearly, you wouldn't argue that that's a, you know, temporal answers it. So I think you're getting back to that it has to be in accordance with that person needs to be listed in this case as an occupant on the lease. Then she would have become a regular occupant, right? Had they gone through the process and she became not a lease tenant, but a regular occupant, right? If she had been listed.
Precisely. And to address Ms. Kaczorek's concerns about what landlords do in holdover situations with tenants who are on the lease, yeah, we don't resort to self-help eviction. Absolutely not. We would do a proper eviction with a notice.
So then I get back to my question with, let's say mom had come and lived there, never got on the lease as an occupant. And yet the landlord knew it didn't appear to approve of that or not object to it. Does the lease still control whether that mom is a regular occupant, even though she was living there with a tacit, you know, a permission, I guess, of a landlord?
Well, I think the argument to be raised by the tenant mom in that situation would be that the landlord did waive through their practice, through their acts, the consent to have mom occupy the property with their knowledge. We don't have that here. We simply don't. I mean, had this been an oral lease, we probably would have taken this case to the Court of Appeals, but we have a written lease here. And the problem we have is that this written lease is being basically ignored. And what other terms of the written lease do we ignore then? I mean, and that is the issue that Ms. Quinn cannot receive greater rights in her tenancy than Ms. Smith had. And that's what has happened here. And that is directly contrary to binding precedent. Thank you.
If I could ask just one more question, but so if this was Ms. Smith who held over, you would have to go into court under that section of the landlord-tenant law, right?
Yes, this would be a 504B285 holdover conviction.
All right, okay.
Of course.
Thank you so much. All right. Ms. Tell me how to pronounce your last name. I'm not even going to try.
It's fine. It's Kaczorek.
Kaczorek. Thank you very much. All right. When you are ready, please proceed.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. May it please the court. My name is Mary Kaczorek, and I am the attorney for the respondent in this case, Kira Quinn, who is with us today on the Zoom call. Someone who's lived in their rental home for 3 years and paid rent is a residential tenant. Both Chapter 504B and Berg v. Wiley state that a landlord cannot change the laws or change the locks on a residential tenant. If a landlord, like appellant, wants a tenant out of their property, all they have to do is file an eviction case. Ms. Quinn is asking this court to affirm the two lower courts who held that she is a residential tenant and that this appellant broke the law. Chapter 504B outlines three different ways where someone can qualify as a residential tenant. The first is, and I'm reading now, a person who is occupying a dwelling in a residential building under a lease or contract, whether oral or written, that requires the payment of money or exchange of services. Here, Ms. Quinn meets that definition. She occupied this dwelling unit for 3 years. She paid rent, $400 a month, to Ms. Smith, who had a lease with the
appellant. Isn't that irrelevant, though, that she paid money to Ms. Smith? I mean, that the landlord doesn't know that. The landlord doesn't see that. It doesn't go to the benefit of the landlord. And I'm just assuming that she didn't start paying rent once Ms. Smith stopped paying rent, correct?
Correct. The landlord here would not accept rent after Ms. Smith moved out.
Is there any evidence in the record that she tendered the rent?
The referee hoteling made a finding of fact that she tendered $400 a month each month to Ms. Smith.
But that's to Ms. Smith, but there's nothing in the record saying she ever tendered the full rent or any rent at all to LMC, correct?
That's correct. And the law doesn't require her to have tendered the rent to the landlord to be considered a residential tenant because she meets the second part of this definition, this other regular occupant definition. The court
did you make the argument? Maybe I missed it. In your brief, were you arguing that she satisfied, Ms. Quinn satisfied the first prong of the definition? I thought we were just focused on regular occupant in your brief.
That's the thrust of our argument, is that second prong, the other regular occupant.
Okay, so let's turn to that. Is someone a regular occupant? Let's figure out what that definition is. And the things that I see floating around are, was it in conformance with the lease? Did it last a certain amount of time? Did the landlord know, irrespective of whether it conformed with the lease? What are we to look at? Tell me if I'm wrong. If someone is secretly living in an apartment unbeknownst to the landlord in violation and not in conformance with a tenant's lease, even if it's been a period of time, maybe you would still call that person a regular occupant. But I would like you to speak to what our court is supposed to consider.
Yeah, so I think the court is correct in considering the temporal aspect. How long has this person been living at this property? That is certainly a factor that should be considered in this analysis. The other way of thinking about regular is in the sense of whether something is customary. Is this person living in this property as is customary for a tenant to be living in their rental home? And here, Ms. Quinn is living there as is customary for a tenant to be living in a rental home. She doesn't have anywhere else to live. She's been living there for 3 years. She gets her mail there. It's the address on her driver's license. She interacts with the concierge. She uses the common spaces. She uses this property as it's her home because it is her home.
Does the landlord's knowledge matter?
The definition in 504B does not include an element of the landlord knowing about the tenancy. So here we have a factual finding that the landlord did know, that they knew for at least 4 months from December 2020 all the way through April that she was living there. And the issue again isn't whether Ms. Smith broke her lease and violated the terms of her rental agreement with an unauthorized occupant. The issue here is whether Ms. Quinn is a regular occupant and whether she can be illegally locked out at the end of the lease or whether she's entitled to an eviction proceeding.
Right. I'm just trying to understand whether you think it's necessary. If we were to do, as Judge Riley aptly asked, what is the definition if we're doing a published opinion? What are the factors or the definition that we add, you know, we flesh out for the statutory term of regular occupant? And I just want to understand what your position is, because there's an emphasis that the landlord knew, but I wonder why you think that matters if it doesn't matter to you.
The factors are outlined in the Fay Hotel case and in the Stone v. Claw case. And those are the length of stay, the existence of a special contract, the rate or method of payment, and possession or non-existence of a home elsewhere. So this court looked at that handful of factors to determine whether a landlord was an innkeeper or a landlord. And your specific question about whether the landlord has to know, I don't think it's our position that they might not have to know. If we're looking at whether the occupancy is regular, it's a fact-intensive case-by-case analysis. And there could, in theory, be a position where someone had been living in a property for multiple years. Maybe it's an absent landlord. Maybe it's like an Invitation Homes or one of those types of arrangements where the actual owner doesn't even live in the state. A person living there as a regular occupant alongside a valid leaseholder can still be considered a residential tenant under that second part of the definition. Minnesota law doesn't require the parties to have a written lease in order for a tenancy to be created. Parties can create a landlord-tenant relationship with an oral lease. But again, here, those factors exist. This landlord knew that Ms. Quinn had been living at the property. And the landlord here is not without recourse. All they have to do is file an eviction case. If at the end of a term lease, a landlord wants a tenant out, they can file an eviction case. If at the end of a month-to-month lease, a landlord wants a tenant out, they give them notice and then they can file an eviction case. Evictions are a summary proceeding, and a landlord can get a tenant out in a matter of weeks. Minnesota is tied for third fastest in the nation for how quickly a landlord can get a tenant out. So Ms. Quinn is not asking for a free ride. She's not asking to stay here forever. All she's asking for is the basic minimal due process that is afforded to her under Minnesota's summary eviction laws.
So I've got a question. Is she still in the unit now? I mean, do we know? And I know it's not in the record. So just tell me, you can restrain yourself to the record, I suppose. But Mr. Kala did mention that there's the moratorium may be impacting this case. I'm just trying to figure out I'm assuming this case is not moot, is all I'm trying to get at.
No, Ms. Quinn still is in the property, and there is a pending eviction case in the district court right now. And Mr. Kala has mentioned the eviction moratorium, but again, this is a lockout case. It's not an eviction case. And Governor Walz enacted the eviction moratorium as a public health safety measure. There's no allegations. There's nothing in the record to suggest that Ms. Quinn posed a danger to other tenants or that any of the other exceptions under the moratorium existed. So again, the issue is whether she can be locked out, not whether the eviction moratorium was a good idea. And again, there is a specific eviction law just for this situation. 504B285 details a process for evicting someone who has stayed too long in the property. It applies to tenants. It applies to situations after a foreclosure, after a tax judgment sale. It's just this sort of situation where someone stays too long. And landlords have to follow this law. They can't just call someone a squatter or a trespasser. They have to follow the law. To say that this appellant can just change the locks on Ms. Quinn would render that entire part of Minnesota's landlord-tenant law completely meaningless. Again, landlord is not without a remedy here. They just have to file an eviction case. The courts in Minnesota have long recognized that it's good public policy to... Go ahead. Oh, sorry. I saw Judge Riley had unmuted herself. Okay, I'll keep going. So Minnesota courts have long recognized that it is good public policy to...
I did have a question. So Mr. Kala relies on the Brasco case. Where is he wrong? And I know that you articulated that in your brief, but just tell us why that case doesn't control the outcome of this case.
Sure. So this case is consistent with Brasco's key holding. Brasco wants to tie that other regular occupant language to a valid leaseholder. And that's exactly what we have here. Ms. Quinn was occupying this property under Ms. Smith's valid lease that she had with appellant. So there is not a conflict between Brasco in this case because the criteria that Brasco outlined are present here. But to the extent that there is a difference, Brasco isn't a landlord-tenant case. Brasco dealt with someone who stayed too long after a redemption period post-foreclosure. So in Brasco, there was no landlord, no leaseholder, no lease, no tenancy. All of those things are present here. Again, we have a lease that Ms. Smith, the leaseholder, had with appellant. She paid rent. This is a landlord-tenant case, whereas Brasco is not.
Well, then to Judge Smith's point and my earlier question to Mr. Kala, what would your syllabus point be? And one of the things you've emphasized in your argument is that the landlord here knew that she was a regular occupant for at least a couple of years, at least since December when they sent her a lease application. So does that become part of the syllabus point for what a regular occupant is?
No, the landlord's knowledge or intent as regards to the occupancy of that person should not be a factor in determining whether someone is a residential tenant. The decision about whether someone is a regular occupant, this court should look to the factors in the Stone v. Claw case. It should look to whether the person has been there for a long time, whether they have another place to stay, where their personal property is stored, whether they're occupying this property as is customary for someone to be living in a rental property. And this court should be unequivocal in its support and defense of Berg v. Wiley. Berg is the seminal case about lockouts in Minnesota. And this has been the overarching policy for Minnesota courts for over 100 years, back to the Lobdell v. Keene case. In that case, this court held that a landlord could not lock out a tenant during the pendency of an appeal. In Bass v. Equity Residential Holdings, this court held that a landlord cannot lock out a tenant after they've lost an eviction court. In that case, the court had ordered judgment for the landlord, but they hadn't obtained the writ of recovery. And during that period, the court held that that landlord still had to follow the eviction laws.
And the I just follow up? And I know that we're focused on this a lot, but to me, it matters in terms of the definition that you're asking us to apply. And so just pragmatically, in some hypothetical future case, landlord knows nothing about someone who's living there, not listed as an occupant on the lease, et cetera. The tenant moves out, they change the doors. Then they learn there's a person there that day. Let's just say, oh, I didn't realize someone was there. At that point, the landlord doesn't know how long or whatever. What's the obligation and what's the landlord supposed to do? They don't know how long the person's been there. They didn't know the person was there. They don't know anything about, you know, whether they have another home, et cetera. What's supposed to happen then, in your view?
If that tenant is asserting that they are a regular occupant, they are a residential tenant, then that tenant is entitled to file a lockout case with the housing court if they're in Hennepin County, or the district court if they're outside of Hennepin and Ramsey. Again, the landlord's remedy there is just to file an eviction case. Under the eviction laws, a landlord can get a writ of recovery that can be executed peaceably by a safety officer within a matter of weeks. So again, because evictions are so fast and so easy in Minnesota, that's the remedy for a landlord in that situation. Those eviction laws exist to prevent harm. Berg talked about harm. The Keene case talks about harm, and that kind of harm happened in this case. Ms. Smith or Ms. Quinn could not leave her property because she knew she couldn't get back in. She ran out of food. She ran out of medicine. She ran out of sanitary supplies. She knew if she left, she wouldn't be able to get back in. So her choice was to stay in this property or to leave and become homeless. And she was right. Appellant did not turn the key fob back on until it was ordered to do so by the housing court. So in conclusion, someone who's lived in their rental home for 3 years is a residential tenant. Landlords like appellant cannot skirt the eviction laws by changing the locks. This process was put in place to prevent harm, and it is not that hard for a landlord to follow that process. For these reasons, we would ask that the court affirm the lower court's finding that Ms. Quinn is a residential tenant and that this appellant broke the law. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And Mr. Kalla, 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. So, like it or not, this case did arrive at the time when we were in the pandemic emergency executive order timeframe. We would not have been able to issue Ms. Quinn a notice to remove, a notice to vacate. We would not have been able to evict her for a holdover. I mean, even now, since October 15th, when we are past the 105 days of the eviction moratorium phase-out plan, if Ms. Kaczorek was correct that evictions in Minnesota are so fast, this case would be moot because Ms. Quinn wouldn't be there anymore. But that's not how evictions work in Minnesota. They are sometimes extremely lengthy, extremely expensive processes for the landlords.
But that would be true, Mr. Kalla, if Ms. Quinn had been listed as an occupant in conformance with the lease.
Right, but had she been listed as a lease occupant on the lease, she would have been somebody who had gone through a background check.
Right, now I understand that. So what's wrong? And let's leave aside the special circumstances of the pandemic, because this statute sure. pre-existed it, and you know, will post-exist it hopefully someday. What is wrong with the idea that you just look at the argument, that you look at the person's tenancy or stay there, I should say, their occupancy there for a long period of time, their sole occupancy, et cetera, and in the normal course of events, pursue the safe and orderly eviction process rather than self-help once the landlord knows, even if they know for the first time on that day?
Affirming this decision is a license to trespass. It's a license to squat. It is unfair to landlords who have gone through the extensive process of drafting leases, doing background checks on all of their tenants, to allow somebody to simply come in their property, flout all of that, live there in open violation of the lease, and then expect that, oh, now they get the due process because the landlord has to follow the statute. When the tenant, the occupant, the trespasser, has done nothing to comply with the lease obligations that they want the benefit of. And that's the problem. Ms. Quinn wants to have it both ways. She doesn't want to go through the background check. She doesn't want to pay any rent to the landlord. She doesn't want to do any of that stuff. But when it comes time to be a tenant, you know, when the lease is up, she wants to stay there. Recall, Ms. Smith gave notice in February that she was going to be not renewing her lease effective April 7th. To the extent that Ms. Quinn is a tenant, she is a subtenant of Ms. Smith. And that tenancy expired at the end of Ms. Smith's lease when she elected to not renew. I mean, Ms. Quinn should have simply vacated. We've already filed the eviction. She's still there. I mean,
but that is one of the differences between the Brasco case and this case. In that case, Brasco's told the person who moved in, you have to be out on this date. That's when the redemption period's up. So the person who moved in knew that it was a limited time that they could stay. In this case, Ms. Quinn didn't know that Ms. Smith had given notice and apparently was unaware that she would need to vacate.
I don't know if that's a fair reading, Judge Riley, of the transcript. If you recall, there's several sections where Ms. Quinn is explaining how she was repeatedly given notices from Ms. Smith that she'd have to leave the apartment, right? I mean, now, none of those actually came to fruition, but regardless, the problem we have here is Ms. Kaczorek wants to put all of the standard, the bullet point, if you will, for what the reported decision should be from the perspective of the person who is claiming to be a tenant, with giving no due regard to what the landlord owner has as their construct for how they're going to run the building that they own, that they manage. A 280 unit building, everybody has to apply, everybody has to go through the background check, everybody has to be on the lease. That is the issue here. And Ms. Quinn didn't want to participate in that process. And now she wants the benefit of having presumably been approved as a tenant from the landlord, and expect that she gets due process when it comes time to the end of her lease. I mean, she wants it both ways. It is not customary for somebody to enter into a property, live there without being on a lease, in a property where a written lease is required by law, 504B111. That written lease is required, and that written lease has been violated since the beginning. To construe her as a regular tenant, a regular occupant, just basically tells landlords, your leases don't matter. And that's a real problem.
All right. Any other questions from the panel? No.